And I see we're still struggling with the IT here. What Google, I thought we all have copies of the presentation. I think we'd rather just continue with the presentation because it's a bit long, so we can't. Oh, is it fine now? Oh, good. I will invite the members on this side to introduce themselves first, and then we'll ask the delegation from Transnet, which is led by Ms. Nonkululeko Cishe, to introduce themselves, and then we can start with our presentation. My name is Peter. I'm Peter Maluleke, a member of the committee.
The committee secretary.
Good morning. I'm Gloria Foreman, member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Chris Hololu, member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Alvin Mugwena, member of the committee.
Morning. I'm Natasha Michael, member of the committee.
Good morning. Goeiemôre. Gerard Marais, member of the committee.
Good morning. Gerard Koornhof, member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Nonkululeko Cishe. I'm the acting group CEO of Transnet.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Anoj Singh, acting CFO of Transnet.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Richard Valleyu, Chief Executive of Transnet Rail Engineering.
Morning. My name is Phyllis DeFedro. I'm the GM in the office of the Group Chief Executive.
Morning. Yuan Bauer, Executive Manager, Finance, Transnet Freight Rail.
Good morning. Patrick Dada, Acting CEO, Transnet Freight Rail.
Good morning, my name is Diva Chaliani from Transnet Communications.
Morning, my name is Londi Webukeleze from Business Report.
Morning, I'm Amoriso from Ethical Solutions.
Morning, Chilesha from PMG.
Mavaro Bani from Parliamentary Communication Services.
Should we continue?
Morning, everyone. Mwako Huma, DPE, Director Financial Analyst, Transport Unit.
Good morning. My name is Lebo Hantu. I'm Beach Department of Public Enterprises, Transport Unit.
Good morning. I'm Raisibeli Pili, the Deputy Director General for Transport Unit in the DPE.
Just as a reminder, what we requested to have in this meeting are the following. I know you all have the program in front of you, the agenda, but I just want to read it out to you. It's a briefing by Transnet on capacity to deliver on this infrastructure problem. Beneficiation, job creation, and skills development. That's
what I mean. Thank you. Transnet is here to present on their bold infrastructure spending plan, which is a 7-year strategy. And on my left, I have Mr. Anoj Singh, who will introduce himself. He will take us through the presentation. Thank you.
My
Chinook. Mr. Chair, as you've outlined the agenda, in terms of the transit infrastructure build program, we thought it necessary just to give the committee a brief overview of what the new transit strategic direction is, and the first couple of slides basically deals with that, and that obviously gives the context within which the 300 billion rand capital spend will be spoken about in more detail in the next part of the presentation.
And just before you start, I just want to, so that we're all clear about how we're going to conduct the meeting. We'll have the presentation. Members will only interject when they raise a point for clarification, and thereafter they will then interact with the presentation as presented to us. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Basically, Transnet has got a new strategic direction, and it's basically called the Market Demand Strategy. And the essence of the Market Demand Strategy is basically to allow Transnet to meet market demand for transportation of commodities and freight products within the South African economy. In order for us to actually do that, we've estimated that we need a capital investment program of 300 billion, and that is the cornerstone of the assumption around how we will go about meeting market demand. In doing the 300 billion capital investment program, we will expand rail, port, and pipeline infrastructure, and we'll see to what extent that expansion will happen over the next 7 years. Increase in capacity to meet market demand, as I've said already. Continued financial stability and strength of the organization, as the committee is quite aware of in terms of our presentations previously. Significant productivity and operation efficiency improvements is encompassed in the plan. A significant shift from road to rail, reducing the cost of overall doing business in South Africa, and carbon emissions in terms of the green economy, and enabling economic growth as a result of all the bullet points that we've mentioned above, as well as significant job creation, skills development, localization, and empowerment and transformation opportunities that the plan actually allows for. In terms of the 7-year, 300 billion expenditure, capital expenditure program, this is a summary of what it looks like. As we've said already, the capital investment over the last 7 years has been in the region of about 120 odd billion rand. Over the next 7 years, we project that to be about 300 billion. It's 154% increase over that period of time. The current employees, the transit employees, about 59,000, including contract workers. We project that to grow to about 74,000 over that period of time, an increase of about 15,000 people, including 4,000 people that will be lost through national attrition. In terms of the growth in volumes, you will see export coal grow from 68 million tons currently, where we estimated to finish the financial year, to about 98 million tons over that period of time, meeting or exceeding the RBCT capacity currently at 91 million tons. Export iron ore growing from 53 million tons to about 83 million tons over that period of time. GFB, where you actually see the significant increase from the current 80 million tons to about 170 million tons over that period of time, which is about 120% increase. And we'll go through, and I'll take you through the details around what commodities actually make up that significant increase in general freight. Maritime containers, you'll see moving from about 4.3 million 20-foot equivalent units, which is TEUs, to about 7.6 million TEUs over that period of time. Again, almost doubling in capacity. In terms of the financials of the organization, and this is just a summary, you'll see the details shortly. Revenue will basically increase from 46 billion to about 128 billion over that period of time. EBITDA grows from 19 billion to 68 billion. And cash flows from operating activities growing from 16 billion to 51 billion. Quite an important measure as a result of the fact that a big bulk of the 300 billion that we're planning to spend will be financed off the strength of Transnet's balance sheet. This is the financial position in a little bit more detail. As you can see, very strong EBITDA margins, where we actually peak at about 54% over that period, 55% over that period of time. We have quite a healthy return on total assets, as you can see, climbing from the 7.3 as we've got in the current year to about 13.3 over the 7 years, and we actually achieve value creation by actually exceeding our weighted average cost of capital over the 7-year period. Gearing, we have managed to maintain gearing at below 50%. We peak at 47.3% gearing, and then as you can see, it tapers off towards the back end of the 7-year period. And cash interest cover, interestingly enough, we've actually been able to maintain it at greater than 3.5 times. And you will recall from previous presentations that we made to the committee that the internal target that we set ourselves for gearing and cash interest cover was 47% for gearing, so we've maintained that internal target. And also for cash interest cover, you'd recall that the internal target that we set ourselves was 3.2. But as a result of the increased capital spend and the associated risk with the capital spend, we've actually increased the internal target to about 3.5 times to actually make sure that we have sufficient headroom to make sure that the strength of the balance sheet is preserved, notwithstanding the fact that we spend the $300 billion over 7 years. I would thought that something that the committee would be interested in terms of understanding how we're actually going to fund this $300 billion capital expenditure plan. And as you can see, a big chunk of the capital investment will be funded from internal generated sources. About 70% of the capital investment will actually be funded through cash generated from operations, and that's why I said it was quite important to understand that the business has a great ability to generate internal cash, as you saw on the first slide. We will be able to redeem a lot of our loans and refinance loans over that period of time as well. And as you can see, the net funding requirement over the 7 years is about $86.5 billion. So we will have to go out to the market and access the debt capital markets to borrow about $86.5 billion over the 7 year period. And as you can see, the probable sources of funding that we anticipate tapping over the 7 year period, basically commercial paper, domestic bonds, the international markets, and bank and other loans. There will be other potential sources of funding that we'll also look at because we never know what's going to happen in the local or the international market, so we will always diversify our sources of funding to make sure that if there is an economic crisis that like what we saw in 2008, we are in a position to still execute and access the debt capital market to execute the $300 billion. So those sources of funding are potential sources that we will basically go out and try and establish in the next 2 to 3 years. But needless to say that the $86.5 billion will be funded of the strength of Transnet's balance sheet. We will not require any government guarantees. The Transnet credit rating will be maintained based on the metrics that we've shown you, and as a result of that, we are confident that we will be able to access the current sources of funding as well as the potential sources of funding that we've actually listed on the slide up here. So basically, that's basically just the nuts and bolts of what the strategy looks like in terms of the financials. And now, as a result of the fact that this committee requested us to focus on the capital spend, the rest of the presentation basically gives you a view of the skills, the competencies, the job creation, the type of investments we'll be making, and as well as certain deep dive into certain projects that we've understood, as well as the back end of the presentation will give you a flavor of how we've interacted with other governmental organizations to actually come up with the plan as well. So basically, the $300 billion capital investment plan, as you can see, is made up of that profile. So we'll be spending $31 billion in this financial year, the 2012-2013 financial year, $37 billion, $39, $48, and peaking at $56 in year 5 of the plan, and then tapering off towards the end of the 7-year period. This profile of capital investments is linked to the volume increases that I've spoken about in the previous slide. So there's a very strong correlation between the capital spend and the volume increase activity that the business is anticipating to see. And that then allows us to generate the cash that will allow us to pay for all of these investments that we bring. As well as the interesting fact on the $300 billion is that you would have remembered, the members that actually saw the financial statements previously would remember that when we presented the expansion and maintaining capital split previously, there was a bias towards the fact that we were spending cash, so the $120 billion that we spent in the last 5 years, a majority of it was actually spent to maintain the cash flows of the organization. So we were maintaining assets that were old, we were maintaining assets that actually gave us incremental revenue, but didn't see a massive increase in volumes. This plan actually reverses that trend, as you can see. In the 12-13 corporate plan, you can see that there's a bigger portion of capital that's actually allocated to expansion activities rather than maintaining activities. 58% of the capital of the $300 billion will go towards expanding capacity and creating additional volumes and renewal of assets, whereas only 42% of the capital will be actually used to maintain assets and maintain the revenue streams of the organization. That picture will change over time, but for the next 7 years, we anticipate that picture will continue to be that split, and that is something that we think that will enable us to have a sustainable business going forward and continue to meet the market demands of the country going forward to support economic growth. In terms of the major investments, $300 billion, where will it go? The biggest portion of the 300 billion, probably about 200 billion of the 300 billion, as you can see in the slide below, on the slide here, actually goes towards the rail operations. So Transnet Freight Rail will benefit from the biggest chunk of the, well, 66% of the 300 billion. There will be a significant portion that goes into the National Ports Authority, and the ports actually take up a bulk of the balance at about 80 billion or so. And there's about 11 billion or so that's for the pipeline. And the 11 billion is for the balance of the current new multi-product pipeline that the committee is also aware of. So there aren't any new pipeline assets that we've actually planned for in the 7-year period. So that will be the 11 billion that will be spent on the NMPP, and that will be the end of the NMPP spending. In terms of split by commodity type, as you can see again, a biggest portion of the capital expenditure is going into something we call the general freight business. The general freight business is the biggest portion of the freight rail business. Other than it's all products other than export iron ore and export coal. And as you can see as well, we've got export iron ore and export coal separately. So they also have quite a chunk of capital investments that's going in. You may want to ask the question, why is there such a significant bias towards general freight? And in the last 7 years, in the last 5 years, we have actually spent quite a bit of capital on the iron ore and on the coal line in terms of sustaining and expansionary capital. And in terms of general freight, now you see that we've actually made the decision to actually make a large investment into the general freight business to actually see that massive growth in volumes over the 7-year period. You will recall that the volume moved from 80 million tons to 170 million tons over the 7-year period, particularly for general freight. And that will enable us to actually see that there will be a general migration of freight from road to rail, as well as supporting Eskom coal and so on and so forth. There's also quite a bit of investment into containers, and this is particularly in the ports, to support the increase in the container volumes. As you saw, that moves from about 4 million TEUs to about 8 million TEUs over the 7-year period. So that's there. The pipe product is the NMPP, and bulk, the 26 billion there, is basically on, again, other bulk products other than export coal and iron ore, and that would be manganese and so on and so forth. The items called other here are basically equipment that we would have purchased, like, for example, port tags and so on and so forth, that are used generally but couldn't be allocated to any specific commodity that we've actually outlined on the pie chart. If we look at the capital investment and what do we buy for this 300 billion, what does the economy get for this 300 billion? Effectively, what it gets, if you look at the 31 billion that we plan to spend on coal lines, we get 98 million tons worth of export coal capacity. The 18 billion that we spend on the iron ore line, we get 82 million tons of capacity on the iron ore line. General freight, 150 billion, we get 170 million tons of general freight moved on the network. 24 billion in containers, 9.4 million TEUs worth of containers we can handle through the port. Obviously, that's in excess of capacity, and therefore you see that we're actually investing ahead of demand. We will only utilize about 80% of that by year 7. In terms of the bulk, again, export iron ore and so on and so forth, 95% capacity utilization. And again, we are investing ahead of demand. Bulk, only 4 billion that we're spending, but again, 52% and 80%, so significant capacity for future growth. NMPP, 7.5 billion or 9 billion that we've mentioned before, at 92% capacity by the end of the 7 years. So again, from a security of supply perspective, there isn't any concern around security of supply because we're still within the 100% capacity that the pipeline will be utilized at the end of the 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, it doesn't mean that you have a problem with the pipeline again. It's just that we will switch on phase two of the pipeline, which will then increase the capacity further as economic growth requires that to be switched on. In terms of the impact of the infrastructure development, I think it's safe to say that the 300 billion will be felt nationwide. As you can see, what we've highlighted here is the job creation impact of the capital investment plan over the 7-year period by province. And as you can see, there is a there's probably in every single province where we've got some sort of impact as a result of the capital investment program. This diagram is also quite interesting in that it gives you a corridor of view of the capital investment. And as you can see, Richards Bay Corridor is probably going to get about $50 billion. And the reason for that is because of the investments in the Port of Richards Bay, as well as the coal line expansion, as well as the Waterberg expansion. In this plan, you will see that we will access the new coal reserves in the Waterberg as well. About 25 million tons worth of coal will actually come out of the Waterberg to service export coal, as well as Eskom needs over that period of time. Durban Corridor, about $38 billion. Again, this is basically in the Port of Durban, the investments in the Port of Durban. But interestingly enough, just to mention in here, the $38 billion does not include the second dugout port that everyone would have heard of. So the $38 billion doesn't include that. The $300 billion doesn't include that either. That will be something that Transnet will actually look at in the next planning cycle as to how it wants to finance and where the funding for that will come from. Along the Eastern Cape, we basically see $25 billion worth of investments in the Eastern Cape. Again, the bulk of that will go into the port of Muha. In terms of converting that into a transshipment hub, we anticipate that the increase in container traffic into the port of Muha will grow to about 2.5 million TEUs over the 7-year period. Currently, it's at about 800,000 TEUs. As well as the fact that we will move manganese to the port of Muha. So we'll see manganese exports grow to about 20 million tons, capacity to about 16 million tons at the end of the 7 years. That will move to the port of Muha, again supporting the industrial, the IDZ, the Kuka IDZ, as well as the two proposed smelters in the IDZ as well, in terms of the iron ore smelters. Sishen Saldanha, again, about $28 billion, supporting the expansion in the iron ore line to the 83 million tons projected over the 7-year period. You see, the Port of Cape Town actually doesn't have much investment over the next 7 years. That's because it's enjoyed quite a bit of investment over the last 5-year period, where we actually have had quite a bit of port capacity created. And you'll recall on the previous slide that port capacity is already, we invested ahead of demand in the sufficient capacity of the port. And one of the ports that actually has a bit of excess capacity at this point in time is the Port of Cape Town. In terms of the job creation as well, this is a slide that just goes into a little bit more detail. As you can see, we've said from a Transnet perspective, we anticipate the workforce growing from about 59 to about 74,000 people over that period of time, 15,000 net employees. But we will probably have to employ about 19,000 people because of the fact that we have 4,000 people that will be lost through natural attrition. So effectively, Transnet will employ about 20,000 people over the next 7 years on its own, on the strength of itself. Then we've got something that's called indirect jobs. Now, indirect jobs are basically jobs that will be created as a result of suppliers being associated with Transnet spend. And that is basically downstream suppliers. And then we've got something called economy-wide jobs over that period of time. Economy-wide jobs is the multiplier effect. As a result of the increase in GDP, as a result of the fact that we're increasing volumes, the reduction of the cost of doing business in South Africa, you have this multiplier effect. And economy-wide, you will create jobs as a result of our activities. And over that period of time, over the 7 years, as you can see, we will see that we will sustain about 588,000 jobs in the economy over that period of time. In terms of Transnet itself plans to spend about just on 7.5 billion rand on training over the 7-year period. That almost equates to about R1 billion a year over the 7 years to actually create skill, create competencies, create a pipeline of people for engineers and so on and so forth, that, and artisans and the like, that we will recruit and we will train in excess of our needs. As we say, if you see here, we've got about 2,000 apprentices at all times in the system. Now, that's the pipeline view. So at any one point in time, we'll have 2,000 people. So if we have 500 people that graduate at any one point in time, the intake immediately thereafter will be another 500 people. So we commit to have 2,000 people in an apprenticeship program at any one given point in time over the 7-year period. Increase in bursar intakes, 543 students, 317 technicians. 4.6 billion will be spent on bursaries and grants. We've got our own schools of excellence, the Rail School of Excellence, the Pipeline School of Excellence, the Port School of Excellence, where we will basically increase the intake in those schools to basically make sure that we have the skills and capacity and competencies to actually execute the 7-year plan. And a lot of the skills and competencies that we'll be creating over the 7 years will actually go towards sustaining what we build in the 7 years. Because we will obviously have a immediate requirement for competencies and skills, which we'll have to go out to the market for. But over the 7 year period, as these skills are actually developed, they will go towards sustaining the next 7 years of the plan going forward. This is a slide that just gives you a ramp up in terms of how we see the 20,000 employees or the 19,000 employees that Transnet will employ directly over the 7 years, as well as the number of engineers, technicians, apprentices, leadership management programs, and chartered accountants that we'll actually have in the system at any one given point in time. And the $7.6 billion will basically go towards funding this increase here, as well as a whole host of other supporting the schools of excellence that we've mentioned just now. A big portion of the $700 billion or the $300 billion plan obviously gives Transnet the unique opportunity that it will be able to leverage off that to ensure that it addresses the imbalances of the past, to make sure that there is transformation within the economy, and the fact that Transnet will be able to support government's initiative to address those imbalances of the past. And obviously, as we can see, what we've already achieved is that we've achieved on the localization initiative a significant amount of transfer of skill, local content promotion, black economic empowerment and transformation as a result of our previous activities on the local side. What we intend doing is we actually intend rolling out what we've experienced and already achieved on the locomotive side in more detail through the $300 billion program. And obviously, as you can just think that what we've achieved, and if we can achieve the same on the $300 billion, there will be massive, massive localization and transformation opportunities. This is just more of a detailed slide in terms of how we would go about actually implementing the transformation and localization initiatives within Transnet. It is very specific. It's very focused. It actually says that if you have a programmatic procurement, we will actually require suppliers that participate in programmatic tenders to have a certain level of localization that they must achieve. For example, on the locomotive side, all tenders now that go out require a 55 to 65% localization content as a minimum. And what we've also done is from a evaluation perspective, we've actually moved the evaluation of the localization element of tenders as being the first gate. So if you do not meet that criteria, you immediately out of the tender. So it's not at the back end of an afterthought that we think about doing this at the end. If you don't have it up front, you don't qualify. So it's something that we've actually insisted on at Transnet, and we actually apply that type of principle in almost all our tenders that go out, so that we've actually moved transformation, localization, empowerment right up at the front. So it's a qualifying gate before you get into anything more than Transnet. And as you move down the chain, I think obviously the opportunities for localization, empowerment, and transformation obviously reduce. But with the reduction, there's obviously other mechanisms that we use to ensure that those objectives are met. In executing the $300 billion, obviously it doesn't come without its risks. And we've analyzed the $300 billion and the business plans, and we've come up with actually internal and external risks. I mean, internal risks are risks that we can manage. External risks are external factors that obviously we cannot manage, but we need to have an ability to respond to. And I think at its heart, we've come up with the fact that we've got three main risks that are basically risks that we as Transnet have to manage. And those are commercial risks, commercial values. You will have seen that the $300 billion capital plan, as well as the volumes, is premised on the basis that we will generate sufficient amount of cash, internal cash. And one of the ways that we anticipate actually generating that cash and having certainty around the volume ramp-ups from our customers is actually to negotiate quite stringent take-or-pay contracts with our customers. So what that means is that we are going to put the investment into the economy. We're going to make the investment on the basis that the customer will also have to make a commitment to us that if we do make the capacity available, they will have to then pay for the capacity whether they use it or not. So that's the commercial value drivers.
The capital investment area, I think the risks there are basically the fact that we need to just create the capacity, firstly, to execute the $300 billion capital spend, which is a massive, massive capital spend. As you can see, the ramp-up to $56 billion in any 1 year is a massive ramp-up. We also have to make sure that when we spend the money, we spend it in the appropriate area. We're spending it on so that the projects are delivered on time, within quality, and within specification, and within budget. In terms of the rail operations, you've seen that the biggest impact on volumes actually comes from rail. And if we do not have a credible rail turnaround plan, I think we'll basically be falling short. So that will also be a focus area for us to ensure that the return on investment that we actually plan to get on the rail business actually is realized, because of the 151 billion rand or 200 billion rand of the capital that's actually going into the rail business. So it needs to be a big focus area of ours. In terms of the external factors, I think the economic factors are something that obviously plays on our mind. If we have another double dip recession as we've seen in 2008, what happens? Economic regulation, two of our businesses are economically regulated at this point in time. The certainty of tariff increases become more important when you're actually targeting a $300 billion capital spend. One of our businesses is the freight rail business is potentially going to be economically regulated, so we need to understand the impacts of that on the $300 billion plan. So I think, you know, we've taken a strategic view around the business, and we've taken a holistic view, and we've understood that these are the risks that we have to manage, and we have to manage these risks in a manner that we actually manage all of them co-synchronously, so that you can't afford any one of them to actually fall or not be mitigated, because if any one is not mitigated, it impacts your plan somehow. So hence we've actually encompassed them in a circle to actually say that we actually have to manage these risks, the portfolio of risks at any one point in time. In response to those risks that we've just mentioned, we obviously knew that when we go out with this plan, or the planned capital spend and realizing the volumes and the operational efficiencies that we've spoken about in the previous slide, we knew that we had to come up with a credible implementation plan that will actually allow us or give us the opportunity to actually achieve what we've said we're going to achieve over the next 7 years. So what we've actually come up with is that we've come up with an implementation plan that actually encompasses the following eight areas. And we've called it the market demand strategy house, because it's got pillars and foundations and a roof and so on and so forth. But this is basically the MDS implementation plan that we will develop. This is planned to be presented to the board either in June or July of this year. That will then be approved, and once it's approved, that will then form the framework of how we implement MDS over the next 7 years. The one area that obviously we'll focus on today as a result of the fact that we're talking about capital is obviously the first pillar, which is optimizing capital investment. And we will go into a little bit of detail as to how we're going to actually implement that in the 7 years. The rest of them obviously will form the detailed plan that we'll table at the board meeting. What we've achieved in terms of the MDS implementation over the last couple of months already, I think is listed here. I don't plan to spend any time on this one. Unless there's questions, I can take those later from the committee. In terms of the capital execution and how we actually plan to implement the $300 billion, as I said before, we as Transnet have already spent 118 billion rand over the last 5 years. Or 7 years. So from that perspective, we have created quite a bit of capacity internally within the business. We've got Transnet Rail Engineering, that is a specialist business that looks after rail, upgrading of rolling stock and the building of new rolling stock. And that has allowed us to spend a big portion of the 118 billion over the last 7 years, as well as an in-house function called Transnet Capital Projects. Transnet Capital Projects is a in-house construction company that effectively does project management and execution of projects on behalf of the Transit Operating Division for projects in excess of 300 million. So we've already created centers of excellence, the Rail Engineering Center of Excellence and the Construction Center of Excellence in TCP and Transit Rail Engineering. So we anticipate utilizing those skills and expanding those skills and expanding those capabilities that we have in those two areas to actually go out and leverage the
leverage on the ability to spend on the $300 billion over the next 7 years. Some of the areas that we probably think that we'll have constraints in, I think in terms of the approval processes going through from whether it be internal or external, internal being FANCEF's own approval processes, external being CFMA approvals from the Department of Public Enterprises, National Treasury, National Treasury funding limits, EIAs from the Department of Environmental Affairs, and so on and so forth, will be problematic, but we'll have to put a process around that to actually ensure that those approvals are obtained at appropriate times. In terms of external procurement, I think procurement in any environment where we're spending in excess of $300 billion becomes a challenge. Skills and competencies becomes a challenge. Project management on the capital execution side becomes challenging again if you look at the South African economy and the build program that we as a country are undertaking, whether it be Eskom, Transnet, or Public Works, or any of the private sector companies. It's well in excess of $1 trillion left. So the skills and competencies becomes an issue. And I think on that basis, we will need to supplement what we have with other sources of skills and competencies. I think we've basically spoken about TCP and TRE. These slides just give you a little bit more detail, so I'm not going to basically dwell on these slides, other than to say that there will be significant changes that will happen within the transfer capital projects environment in order for them to start delivering on the $300 billion. And we have thought about this in terms of understanding whether TCP needs to go through a radical change. When I say radical, I mean that they must change within the next 3 to 6 months or 12 months to enable them to execute the $300 billion. And the way in which the $300 billion is actually planned to be spent, you'll see that in the detail, obviously, it's not available here, but the way you'll see is that TCP only needs to ramp up and create its capacity to meet the capital ramp-up in the next 2 to 3 years. So again, it gives us a little bit of room to start creating the capacity that we require within the TCP environment to meet that challenge. On the rail engineering side, however, because of the manner in which the ramp-up happens, they have to ramp up much sooner rather than later, because a big chunk of the spending in the first 2 to 3 years actually happens on the rail side, where we're procuring locomotives, where we're procuring wagons, where we're actually building locomotives and wagons, and we're actually refurbishing locomotives and wagons. So on the rail engineering side, a lot of that upskilling has to happen immediately, and to that extent, a lot of the upskilling has already happened. Because if you recall, for those committee members that have been in the past, we've always spoken about the fact that rail engineering has already transferred a lot of skill from the original equipment manufacturers like GE, Mitsui, EMD, and the like, by virtue of the fact that the localization initiatives that have already occurred through TRE. So from a build perspective, in terms of the locomotive builds going forward, a lot of that skill already resides within TRE. From a wagon build perspective, again, they have been building wagons for Tierpart in the past. So it's not as if we design new wagons, it's just the quantity of wagons that increased over that period of time. So it again comes back to setting up additional production lines, getting additional people to actually build the wagons. So from that perspective, we obviously de-risk the plan to a certain extent. But again, from a TRE perspective, all is not hunky-dory in terms of the fact that they will have to also go through some sort of change, and we've tried to articulate that on this slide to say what does happen within the TRE environment that's not happening today, but needs to happen over the next 3 to 4 years in order for them to deliver on MBS. So that's basically talking about the internal capacity. Then if you look at the entire portfolio of capital projects, we've actually looked at the implementation plan for the delivery of the capital projects in two phases. The first phase of delivery of the capital project is to ensure that we deliver 12-13 capital projects, $31 billion intact. So that's the short-term phase that we're saying, if we can deliver the $31 billion for the current financial year, we'd have a tick for our performance in terms of the corporate plan. So basically what we said is, let's go and do and let's understand what we need to do to ensure that come next year, 31 March, we'll have delivered $31 billion worth of capital. So that is the next couple of slides I'll go through. We'll basically talk to how we anticipate that happening. The second phase of the capital plan actually entails building a capital capability that's actually a sustainable capital organization over the next 7 years, into the next 15 years, into the next 20 years. And that is the next or the phase two of the capital expenditure plan implementation that will create the capability and sustainability going forward. And that is what will then make sure that the $300 billion in the next 6 years actually gets delivered. It gets delivered on time, within budget, and within scope. So that will be the next part of the next couple of slides that I'll talk about. So basically, in terms of making sure that we deliver the 12-13 budget, we went through and we said we need to identify the project pipeline. So what are the projects that we need to deliver in? What are we going to be spending over the next year? And let's understand how we need to prioritize this from an approval perspective, from an execution perspective, from a project management perspective. What skills do we require? What competencies do we require? Do we have the right skills? Do we have the right competencies? Do we need to hire more people? Don't we need to hire more people? Do we need to move resources from one OD to the other? So this process is basically the process that we've identified here. And in going through that process, we've defined mitigating actions where we've actually found gaps in specific ODs. This slide basically takes you through a summary of that process. That process that we went through on the previous slide has culminated into this slide in terms of saying from a TFR infra, which is TFR infrastructure, TFR fleet, which is TFR rolling stock, which is locomotives and wagons, TPT is transport terminals, TNPA is transport authority. This slide basically says, along those entities that we mentioned there, how confident are we that they will be able to deliver on the 31 billion rand capital spend? From a capital execution perspective, capital approval perspective, and from a procurement perspective. Because those are the three main levers that you would find in any capital delivery program. And as you can see, we've assessed that. We're currently in the closeout phase of that program and of this process at this point in time, and that's why you see the question marks there, because we were not able to close out before the meeting as to what that assessment is. But what I can assure you, the committee, is that at the end of this process, each of the business units will have a robust plan that will be developed that they will then have to manage over the next 12 months that will enable them to deliver the $31 billion in capital plan. At this stage, the main themes that are coming out of this analysis is that we require skills and competency enhancements in capital project management and business case development, as well as capital procurement. So what we've actually done is that we've actually gone out and created a concept of SWOT teams. So we will create SWOT teams for capital procurement, as well as capital business case development and execution. We've already developed a series of RFPs that will go out into the market to actually basically see if the market has those skills. If the market has those skills, we insource those skills, contract them for a period of 10 to 12 months, and ensure that we deliver the 12-13 plan while we augment the organization to actually create those internal capabilities over this 12-month period. This goes into more detail around the procurement activity in terms of how we've analyzed procurement. So I don't intend going through this, and we can take questions on this slide when the committee has the opportunity. In terms of the next phase, this was the two phases that I was talking about. The next phase of the capital implementation plan actually talks about developing a gold standard or platinum standard or whichever one you want to call it. But it basically comes up with a standard as to how we should actually execute capital projects within a Transnet environment. Currently, we are executing projects. We have a project lifecycle methodology called the PLP, which obviously governs the way we execute capital projects. This gold standard basically will take a capital project from its inception right up to the end of the capital when you actually build it and actually go out and deploy it. And it will tell you at each level, what should you be doing? And it actually is a process flow type of standard. And obviously in any process flow type of standard, you have a level 1 process, level 2 process, level 3 process, level 4 process, 5 and 6. And each level obviously goes through a different level of detail. Level 1 being the highest level, level 6 being the lowest level. And level 6 will be at an execution level, and level 1 will be obviously at a process strategic level. And in these different levels of that will be mapped out for each of the ODs will be very specific procedures and policies and controls that each of the ODs will have to be executing as it relates to their capital projects going forward. So on that basis, we are quite comfortable that once we roll out this gold standard for the ODs, you will find that we will be in a position to make sure that the capital projects that we deliver will be the appropriate capital projects, they will be at the appropriate value, there will be appropriate scope, and we will mitigate any schedule overruns and cost overruns as a result of that. That is the main aim of this gold standard. So that when we actually come back to the committee and say, have we spent the $300 billion? We can say, yes, we spent the $300 billion, and it was within scope, on time, no overruns, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that is the main aim of this gold standard that we're developing. And this basically just gives you a little bit of a timeline in terms of when we anticipate each of these things happening. The next section of the presentation basically just goes through a list of mega projects as we see them, contained in the $300 billion capital plan, and each of the phases. As I've mentioned before, if we look at the first one, the Durban International Airport site, what we've budgeted for in the seven-year plan is basically the acquisition of the land only. It has not been budgeted for in terms of the development of the port. As you can see at the bottom of the picture there, that is what the port will actually look like in its completed phases. So basically, the Durban Dugout Port, you're actually seeing what it will look like, and obviously up the road there is the old port. So Durban will actually have two ports in the next 10 years. And as you can see, in terms of the phases, phase one will create 2.4 million TEUs worth of capacity, so 2.4 million TEUs will be coming on stream in our estimation by year 2020 or anywhere between 2020 and 2023, depending on economic growth. But on a low road scenario, we probably anticipate that the 2.4 million TEUs will be required by year 2020. And then we've got phase 1, 2, 3, 4, moving up to about 2.4 million TEU increments over that period, over the next 10 to 20 years. Continued developments in the Port of Durban. We have made significant investments in the Port of Durban previously, as the committee will remember. These are basically now investments that we will be making to improve the operational efficiency of the port terminal operations, rather than making configurations and deepening. There will be some deepening of the berth and the entrance harbour channel as well, but not significant. But the most of the investments will actually be going into the Pier 1 area, as you know that there are issues with Pier 1 in terms of the operation efficiency at Pier 1. So there will be a significant investment going in there to make sure that we have state-of-the-art equipment that will obviously support the operation efficiencies that we actually anticipate seeing in that pier. Cape Town expansion, as I've mentioned before, you know, there is quite a bit of spending in Cape Town, but we have historically done quite a bit of investment in the Port of Cape Town as well, so there's not much going in there at this point in time over the next 7 years. The Port of Wuhan, as we said, $9 billion that will probably be spent there. There's a whole list of equipment that we will be purchasing to support the increasing volumes from the 800,000 TEUs to the 2.4 million TEUs, as well as another big investment will be the increase the movement of manganese to the Port of Wuhan over this period of time. Iron ore expansion. Basically, here we're not going to be doing anything fancy other than buying new locomotives, more wagons, increasing the number of loops. The number of loops is basically just things that we create on the line that actually allows more than one train to operate on the line at the same time. So this is basically really infrastructure related, moving capacity to 83 million tons over that period of time. The export coal line as well, significant ramp up to 97 million tons over the 7 year period, and a significant investment in over that period of time as well. But again, from an infrastructure perspective as well as a fleet perspective in terms of acquiring new locomotives and new wagons. This is basically giving you a summary of the locomotive acquisition program. This slide basically outlines what locomotives have already been contracted for and when we anticipate the delivery to happen. So this slide should be familiar to the committee members that have seen this in the past. So there's nothing new on this slide. In terms of the rolling stock program, in terms of what we anticipate acquiring in the seven-year plan, this is something new that the committee members have not seen before. So basically, we anticipate spending about $44 billion on locomotives over the seven-year period, as well as about $25 billion on wagons over the seven-year period. This is new. That's not been contracted for. This will be contracted over the next 7 years. And actually, in the first 3 years of the 7 years, this will be contracted for. Significant acquisition of locomotives, about 1,300 locomotives, diesel and electrics, for the coal, iron ore, and general freight business. The biggest chunk of those locomotives will go into the general freight business to support the increase in volumes. 25,000 wagons, again, a big chunk of the 25,000 wagons will go into supporting the general freight business, as well as iron ore and coal, to ensure that we'll be able to meet up the increased volumes of coal and iron ore, as well as a big chunk of the wagons that we currently have that will go through a upgrade program. So we have existing wagons that will be upgraded to ensure that they extend their life and increase their capacity in using. Some of the wagons, 25,000 wagons, will basically go into automotive wagons, mineral wagons, general mining wagons, as well as flatbeds for containers. Manganese, as we mentioned before, already is about 11 billion rand investment in manganese, basically moving manganese capacity to about 16 million tons. I know the industry is probably only in a position to supply about 14 to 15 million tons, but again, we will be making capacity available ahead of demand in this area of the business. The Swazi Rail Link, again, the committee members may have seen some press around the Swazi Rail Link. The Swazi Rail Link's main objective is to actually create a debottlenecking of the coal line. Currently, we have general freight traffic that moves along the coal line, as well as coal trains. The fact that you have general freight traffic on the coal line means that the coal trains have to naturally move slower because the general freight trains move slower. So it actually reduces the operational efficiency of the coal line as a result of that. So what we're going to do by creating the Swazi Link is to actually divert the general freight through Swaziland and debottleneck the coal line, allowing the operational efficiency of the coal line to be improved, thereby moving more coal to the coal line just by virtue of the fact that you move at higher speed. And this is basically budgeted 5 billion, and the 5 billion is basically only the SA portion, assuming that the Swazi portion will be funded by the Swazi government. The coal opportunity, the Waterberg coal, I think we've spoken about this as well in terms of the Waterberg previously, and as you can see, we estimate that phase one of the Waterberg will probably yield about 23 million tons of coal.
Sorry, Commissioner, did I hear Mr. Singh saying that as far as the Swazi rail line is concerned, you assume that to be financed by the Swazi government?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What we've got in our budget is the South African portion of it. And at this stage, the Swazi government has indicated that they have sufficient sources of funding to fund their portion. In terms of the MOU that we've signed with them, that's what they've indicated as to whether that will pan out.
Which is how much, because we have advanced a guarantee of 2.4 billion. I'm not debating. I'm just saying that we should have a wishy-washy assumption.
But what Mr. Singh said, there is commitment from the Swazi government.
Yes.
Is it palpable? That's not going to be a palpable assumption. I mean, they will just lend them money, and then they assure us that they will be able to finance. Based on what?
Mr. Chair, there has been an MOU signed between, I think it's Transnet Public Enterprises and the Swazi government around the manner in which we'll execute this. One of the things that they have indicated in there is that sufficient funding is available.
Yeah.
And they've also indicated there's some U.S. donor funding or so on and so forth that will probably come through. But again, if it doesn't come through, then we'll revise that and review it in the next planning cycle. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the Waterberg, I think the Waterberg coal, as I said before, will go towards export coal to a lesser extent and obviously supporting Eskom's domestic coal demand. In the plan, I haven't mentioned this, but maybe it's an opportune time to mention it, is that we actually see Eskom coal volumes growing quite significantly over the 7 year period from the current 9 million tons to in the region of about 30 million tons over the 7 years. And that's for two reasons. The first reason is for Eskom's road to rail migration plan, which we're obviously seeing the benefits of. And then secondly, because of the fact that they've got new coal power stations coming on stream, which obviously requires more coal. And this is a slide that actually talks to that, actually. So I was actually one slide ahead of myself. There's the ramp-up that we see from the current 7 million tons to about 30 million tons over the 7 year period. And as I said, it's because of those two reasons. Richard Bay, the Port of Richard Bay will actually see quite a bit of significant investment compared to the past. As we can see that the total investment in Richard Bay will probably be in the region of about 11 billion, right? And that is a significant amount of investment compared to what it saw in the past. It has been a neglected port in the past, and this significant investment that we see here recognizes that now. And you will see that there will be a significant amount of increase in volumes as a result of this investment that we're seeing in the port of Richards Bay. This slide basically just tries to encapsulate and gives you a view that we haven't ignored the rest of the ports. There is still amounts that are planned to be spent in the rest of the ports. We focused on the bigger ports. We focused on where the volumes are, but this slide just should give the committee comfort that we haven't ignored the rest of the port. Critical maintenance volume opportunities that we've seen in the other ports is backed up by capital investments, as you see on the slide. The new multi-product pipeline, as I've mentioned before, we anticipate just that the ETC is currently still at $23.4 billion, as we've reported to the committee in the past, and we're probably seeing that there's probably about another $8 billion worth of spend to come in the next 7 years, with the bulk of which will happen in the next two. And once that happens, it's really just maintaining capital expenditure that will be spent on the pipeline going forward. Mr. Chair, these next three slides just basically outline the fact that we as Transnet have actually taken into account and workshopped with the National Planning Commission, as well as the provinces, as well as the other organs of state in developing the $300 billion capital plan. And we continue that engagement with the organs of state and the other processes and policy departments to continuously augment the plan, and each of the planning cycles as we go along will be picking up any of the projects that we should have picked up or have not picked up into the $300 billion going forward. As you would know, that the $300 billion that we've got is a seven-year rolling $300 billion plan. This slide just basically encapsulates our engagements with the National Planning Commission. Here, this slide 48 basically just outlines the impact on each of the provinces and what activities and what projects we'll be undertaking on a provincial basis. Here we basically outline our role in the 2050 vision in terms of the Durban to Gauteng corridor. And I think here again we just identify and align with the hubs and terminal strategy that government has in place. Mr. Chair, that's about the presentation, and we can.
Thank you so much, Mr. Smith. I think we'll have a short break now after this before we get into interaction with the presentation. There's tea here. We'll have just 5 minutes. 5 minutes break, so everybody just grab a cup of tea.
And then on our side we've got DDG Transport, we need some participants applied.
I'm in the Bahamas and I'm from Capricorn Country and the city of
Minnesota.
Yes, I appreciate that. She's out now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just a great
okay,
heat.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Good.
We're just not invite viewers to that beach.
You're going to encounter him somewhere, and you're going to encounter me somewhere. So that's it, go.
So we're not going to have a good time.
Yeah.
But because of this,
sure. There's a lot happening.
Yeah. I doubt it will.
Take it, but here's a piece of soap.
Empty.
such a trouble, that is why I'm running away now.
Did someone already sell all it?
kore ka sithe ba ba tlo kreya ba fumela dilo tse dingwe.
Yeah, she was like, okay.
Yeah. She didn't know this lady, right? Next had to be that lady. Make it tomorrow morning.
Oh, it's okay. I can't answer. I think probably Naling.
Let's go 6 months. Yes, sir. Okay. We need no harm for the human. Okay. We people to go and go and look at that induction near board.
Shall we? Before we invite members to interact with the presentation, I just wanted to find out from your side, is there anything else that you would like to add to this issue?
Nothing.
Nothing? Okay. Members, it is now your chance to... Honorable Michael, Honorable Marie, Honorable Kuerana, Mukwena, Honorable Bowman, I've got just a very small. You know, you said when you on that gold standard that is like monitoring whether or not you are on track. You said you will come to the committee. No, you didn't say you'll come to the committee. That will help you to see that you have achieved what you want. What we would actually like to see to be part of the process, that the committee be informed as the process unfolds, that not that we have been, that we are on track, so that when there are challenges, we can together, you know, unlock or unblock whatever challenges there are, so that we don't get involved at the tail end when there are challenges, and now we have to, you know, go and unscramble something that we haven't been informed timelessly about. I think that will be very helpful. So we will, and I think you also on your side help us to establish how often that will take place. Honourable Michael.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the presentation. Allow me to dive straight in with asking a quick question about the Durban Dugout Harbour. And this happened, an interesting issue occurred, I think, if I'm not mistaken, in March. On the same day, Ryan Malefi made a statement saying that the pier would be extended to the Salisbury island. And we see here that the plans are well underway. But on the same day, Defence Minister Lindiwe Sisulu announced plans for Salisbury Island to become the hub for anti-pirate activity around the South African coast. So could I just have a little bit of explanation as to what exactly happened there and exactly what is Salisbury Island going ahead with Transnet's idea, and will part of it be an anti-pirate hub, or what exactly is the situation? Because this is a question we get asked by a lot of people docking in Durban Harbour and wishing to expand their future docking purposes there. So an answer there, please. Then I would also like to ask the question about the Transnet pensioners. In all these plans that I see and all these billions of rands that are going to be spent and the 15,000 new employees that will come into employment, including the 4,000 that will retire due to age, etc., I don't see anything about cash injections into the Transnet pension fund. Now, you will know better than anyone that out of the 78,000 Transnet pensioners, 40% of those receive less than 1,500 rand a month. And I must say I was most concerned when Transnet spokesperson Mbiso Singonyela made the statement saying that Parliament had not obliged Transnet to make any injections into the fund. We then had Mr. Malefi make the statement that the bonuses that were paid into the pensions are done on a highly ad hoc basis, because the 2 billion rand, which was intended by Transnet to be injected into the pension funds, Transnet stressed its inability to inject money into this fund. Now, we've seen our president stand up in the State of the Nation address and encourage a growth especially in the sector. But how are you going to encourage skills development and the attraction of a skilled labour force into your company if people know that they have the chance of retiring and knowing that they will receive pensions of less than 1,500 rand? Also, how do we justify to these thousands and thousands of men and women who have given their lives to a company that we now have all these billions made available, and we are talking multi-billion rands, and yet Transnet stresses that it cannot inject 2 billion rand to make their old age and having given their lives to Transnet worth something? So if we could have an answer on that and where we stand at the moment with regards to a cash injection. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I first want to go to page 12 of the presentation. On the right-hand side is localization of initiatives. The fifth bullet point is on top. Assistance will be provided to small business to foster innovation and create jobs, and the one job benefit, 4.2 billion, expected to be spent on the 7 years on small business promotion. How are you envisaged to do that? I think give me a little bit more background to that. I also would like, if you can give me a little bit more background to what you envisage to do with back of port activities, sub economic activities to support the port activities. Then on page 48. That's alignment with other planning processes in government, provincial engagement. I want specifically to go to the Western Cape one on the left bottom. I've seen there in Trading Corridor, Saldanha, Cape Town. Just want to mention, and it's interesting, just a relook. I've seen the plans to double the N7 up to Malmesbury. But coming from Saldanha, I just want to mention it's the R27 running along the coast, and direct access to maybe link between the Saldanha port and the Cape Town port is the R27 and not the N7, unless you take a road from through Darling or Hopefield from Sadana Bay, going to the N7, and then you can come out at maybe and then at Marmot Bay. I just mentioned that because that's interesting that you actually look at the N7 and not the R27. Okay, that's the right one. And then I just request two things, other things that would be interesting. Page 50 as well. Just look at the various indications you made for the various ports. And in the terminal, I've seen Saldana is only actually noted to be a mineral node. A mineral node. Is there no long-term planning, maybe? I know this is actually for the next 7 years, but do you have this, is anything in mind? If there's an overspill of activities, being that Cape Town Harbour could, in the long term, long run, could be, you know, too small, and maybe some port activities could be shifted to Saldana Bay, because it's actually the only deep-sea natural harbour after Cape Town on the west coast. Okay, and I would like, if you're just going to respond on that, I would really appreciate. And the other just request, I'll give my email to you, if you can give me maybe a little more detail about what your plans are for the Saldana Bay, because there's very few things mentioned in detail about Saldana Bay, upgrading of the port and anything that goes with that, please. If you can send me anything, I would really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to Mr. Singh and his team for a very impressive presentation. I will refrain from the temptation to talk about our plan, because this is really its potential to be a plan for all South Africa, to become a national asset and to really to roll out for to the advantage of all people in South Africa, this rollout of this plan. The real test will be in the implementation. And I hope that you will be frank enough as you roll out this plan that if there are hiccups and problems, that you will acknowledge it, be open-ended about it, be transparent about it, and to say there's a problem, and come to the committee and explain. I would have liked in your presentation that you could maybe spell out more precisely what are the benefits for ordinary South Africans. How will the ordinary South African benefit from all your 50 pages that you've indicated to us on your various divisions and subsections of your business units? I want to make a statement. We need much more than 300 billion. Much more, double, maybe triple that amount to address the backlog, the future expansion, and the maintenance. If that's true, I don't see anything in your plan here where you involve other role players as well. Surely you cannot do this on your own. You cannot fly solo. I'm talking beyond the 300 billion. What plans do you have to involve in a partnership, in a cooperation between state-owned company like yourself, Tarknet, and the private sector? I would like you just to spell it out. What are your plans in regard to cooperation with the private sector? The final test of your plan presented to the committee this morning will be your capacity to deliver. I mean, you talk about, for instance, your Saldana ore export corridor, iron ore export corridor, moving from 60 million ton to 82 million ton. You talk your Eskom coal transportation from 7 million ton to 30 million ton. You talk about the Durban new harbour dugout program. You talk about the expansion of the harbours on those two. You have the resources on the Waterberg, your coal, Sisson, your iron ore. But you have to move that iron ore from the source to the harbour. You have to move the coal in the Waterberg to the Durban port. What assurances can you give us, this committee, that you will have the capacity to move physically that huge increase of amount of tonnage to your various ports that you've explained to us? Then my last question, in a previous presentation you said to us that the rail freight rail is really not up to standard. You're not on time, there are delays. I can't remember, the CEO said once the longest delay was 180 days of a train to depart. So it's massive. Sometimes beyond your control, because the goods are not delivered, so the train has to wait. What assurance can you give us that you, in future, on this plan, will make sure, I'm talking freight rail, that it will be on time, it will be reliable? And lastly, currently you use the Cape gauge. 2 years ago we had a joint meeting between yourselves and the Department of Transport. Transport spoke about standard rail gauge. Who's going to win this fight? Where are we going? If I listen to your presentation today, you say the road for South Africa, the rail, freight rail for South Africa to follow is a Cape gauge. If I understand the Department of Transport, they say no, it's standard gauge. Where is this debate? And how do we oversee that we can really look at this issue to make sure that we are on the right track and don't run into one another? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Oh, is that a new Mr. Mugwena? No. I don't mind that much blame. Okay. Is it my turn? Okay. Thanks.
About cooperation with the private sector and the question around your different views or seemingly different views between yourselves and transport. The factory, for instance, that you're talking about, you're going to build the wagons and stuff, because transport is also talking about building coaches and all sorts of ambitious program that they also have, just like yours. You know, whether or not we're going to have two factories, separate factories, one from yourself and then transport having their own factory. Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. Also echo the sentiment that I complain that the sentiment that is a very thoroughgoing report and a plan which is characterized by a lot of thoughtfulness. It's really empowering to us as MPs to see that can have a state-owned company that can actually do good research work. Because on the normal circumstances, it wouldn't have been very convincing to present such a report. That's point one, by way of general comment. A few quick points. Number one, Chairperson, I've actually been worried as a parliamentarian, having been here from 1994, that virtually all state-owned enterprises since 1994 have stopped declaring dividends. They've just stopped. The last report I had was by Eskom, who presented a check of 60 million, 1994, and that was the end of the story. From there, it has never, there's always been requests for further recapitalization with a lot of credible motivation, money for this, da-da-da-da-da. Now, I'm saying the government is not a business. But you see, the government owns these businesses.
So, and the government has got the political agenda of development as now we must maintain the balance between developmentalism and entrepreneurship, right? I would like to see a situation where all these state-owned companies come up and say, this is how much profit I've made, and this is the dividends to you, the government, as a shareholder, DPE, and then they come up and say, look, now, please, can you recapitalize us? It's credible. Money must come. It's just the way on the street where money doesn't get siphoned out, to a point where the government says, whoa, we're not going to finance it anymore. Then, but then what happens is they say, oh, thank you very much. I'm not financing us. I want us to be sustainable. Fine. You'll never hear from us. And just carry on with all these huge plans forever and ever. And I ask myself, will the voters be very happy that we keep on saying the government owns businesses? And then we give them all these fancy reports that what is an infrastructure development, et cetera, et cetera. Why is the money going to flow back by way of a dividend to the state? And that doesn't only affect Transnet, it cuts across all these state owned companies. It's a fundamental point in terms of equity or shareholding. Now, I want to hear your comments on that. Number two, we are a bit worried about this 8.4 billion. Not that we definitely want to pillory for the 8.4 billion financial mismanagement. It was, well, the CEO and the chairperson came here, and they gave us what appeared to be a credible explanation. But we want that money to be recovered. You can't just say, oh, no, 8.4 billion has been wrongly spent, and sorry, we won't do it again. We've got a new management plan. It does not work out. Scopa called you after we have actually called you, and they've agreed with you. There's no need for that, God. Now we exercise oversight over you, and we shouldn't be seen not to be doing our work because the public is actually watching. So that 8.4 billion, we still need to have a sound explanation of how, what plans you have to recover. Well, most of that money at least, because financial delinquency is the financial delinquency. That malfeasance can't just be condoned. Otherwise, it will just carry on and on when the new management says, oh, well, you guys, we're not going to be as bad as the previous ones. Sorry, it's 18.5 billion this time. You know, so can't carry on like that. The other little point, Chairperson, quickly, is the question that relates to the fact that, you know, Transnet, you're talking about this, it's 300 billion. And I think one of the perspective on that is, right, you probably need more money. But the point is this, that Transnet, we cannot just operate as an island, as the South African rail infrastructural outfit. We must link ourselves, our plans must be linked to the African Union. And the ministers of trade industry of 26 countries out of the 54 in Africa have come together and they've constituted themselves into a trading bloc. Now, transport is obviously in rail, obviously very essential there. Now, I would like to see how, apart from the rail gauge dimension, how you actually bring them on board in terms of them contributing so that now we can operate continentally as well. Across the continent, it's not just having a very beautiful infrastructure here on the southern tip of the continent. And, well, I think let me just stop the chairperson for the moment, and then with your grace, perhaps I could get another thought in the second round. I don't want to hog the stage. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Perhaps I would just come in now to what's left to say, and I think this is related, for example, to the query that was raised on the Swazi Rail link and their contribution, you know, signing this MOU and so on. With all your forward planning, have you taken all your costings into account? We're talking huge money here, and you know, one has already seen that in some of our big projects, we've got huge under-costings. Now, in the 7 years that lie ahead of us, are we going to find that the 300 billion becomes 600 billion or 800 billion? And I'm not talking about the extra that we are going to be requiring. I'm talking specifically on the 300 billion. That's the one thing. The other thing with the big spend, and I'm really following up here on the Honourable Mokoena, and that is my question is, how sure are you that you've got everything in place in the spending of this money that will avoid mismanagement, corruption, fraud, all those good words that seem to come out from time to time? And I'm not saying with Transnet only, but, you know, how are we going to ensure that this money is spent in a very transparent and open way? Then I want to ask a question here. You talk about your assets and your balance sheet and being able to borrow on that now. I also have the privilege of serving on the Human Settlements Portfolio Committee. Now, I want to pose a question here. We have the Housing Development Agency that are, they've been out there identifying land, and this land has been sitting on their books, and they're not able to actually take possession of it. And Transnet is owning. Now, the explanation that we get is that, you know, it's part of your balance sheet and the money, and we need that land released. So we're anxiously waiting to be able for HDA to be able to conclude those deals, if we can have some explanation as to whether you're desperately hanging on or whether not. Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson. Mine would be a little one. I think you mentioned that you are training people to replace your aging workforce. Now, one is interested when you juxtapose those two. One is interested whether you are matching the numbers and how negatively does that impact on your operational nerve as you are busy addressing it. Thank you.
I have the ability to answer some of these questions, I'll take them. If I don't need them, I'll just pass them through the team. Mr. Chair, in response to your first question around the request for, let's call it a real-time update on potential issues in terms of the capital execution and challenges, I think, Mr. Chair, that's not an unrealistic request. We obviously monitor the capital execution ability of the organization on a monthly basis. As EXCO and obviously the board looks at that on a quarterly basis, and we obviously report through to DPE as the shareholder representative as required by the PFMA on a quarterly basis as well. If the committee is desirous of having reports, I think we can basically make those reports available. That's not too difficult a task from our side. In terms of the question around DIA and Salisbury Island, the use thereof, the latest developments on the Salisbury Island issue is that we are currently in discussions with the Department of Public Works to conclude a 99-year lease agreement on Salisbury Island. And I think those were quite advanced, well, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of us being able to sign that lease quite shortly with the Department of Public Works. So I think in response to the Honourable's question, I think that's really what the use of that property will be. In terms of the piracy activities, I know there were some discussions around the use of Richards Bay and so on and so forth, so there might be some movement of those activities to Richards Bay rather than in the Port of Durban. Around the question around Transnet's ability to inject cash into the TSPBF, the response to that in terms of the current seven-year plan, you quite rightly conclude that there isn't any planned injections into the pension funds as they stand now. However, having said that, we have, together with the portfolio committee, actually gone a long way to actually address some of the concerns of the pensioners in terms of the targeting of a CPI-related increase for the pensioners as it relates to the TSDBF and the TPF. Members will recall that we made a presentation on the 25th of November. We have progressed in terms of issuing the five-month backdate. All of those payments were made as of the 25th of February this year. In addition to that, I know that the TSDBF has requested additional bonuses to be paid to their members as well. So to that extent, over the last 5 years, pensions have seen significant increases in their pension, albeit on an ad hoc basis, but they have seen regular payments that have been made to them, at least in February and November of each year, as a result of these ad hoc payments and bonus structure that we actually have in place. In terms of attracting skilled laborers as a result of the perception that the TSDBF has in terms of them not being able to have a livable pension, the Honourable Member might not be aware, but the TSDBF is actually a closed fund. The TPF is also a closed fund. So there aren't any new employees of Transnet that actually get onto these funds. So in terms of the pension of the 55,000 people or the 59,000 people that we currently have on our pay list actually belong to something called the Transnet Retirement Fund, which is a defined contribution fund, and basically whatever a member contributes based on the market performance is what their pension gets. And that is pretty much the industry norm out there at this stage. So any new employees coming in would not be tainted by the perceptions of the TSDBF because they will have their own fund that they will actually go out and join. In terms of the 4.2 billion rand on small development, the question was asked in terms of how we plan to actually do that. In terms of the 4.2 billion over the next 7 years, we've got very specific programs. One of the programs that we've highlighted is obviously some sort of incubator program that currently is being run by some industry participants, where you actually identify very specific companies and incubate them for a period of time to actually get them to a certain standard, and once they're to a certain standard, they become eligible to actually participate in transfer tenders and so on and so forth. We've actually earmarked for the current financial year an amount of about 25 million that will be transferred into the incubator fund that will then be used to develop these small businesses over the period. And obviously over the 7 years, that's just one initiative. There are other initiatives in terms of the procurement spend generally that will go out and actually target small business development. Some of the things that we will use to do that is something called, let's call it an inverse comma, set aside. So where we actually identify, for example, an opportunity that one of our tenders would lend itself to small business development, we'll actually go out an open tender, but set aside that tender exclusively for small business, and we'll define what small business is, so that the people that respond won't be people like multinationals and big corporates. But again, set aside, I say, within inverted commas, it has to be within very specific rules and requirements that we will define, because set aside in terms of the rules or the legislation of the country is not allowed. So we will basically create very specific rules as to how we actually define what the set aside is and why we're defining it as such. So that's some of the ways we'll do that. The back of port activities, I think a big portion of what back of port activities will relate to the Durban International Airport Center. Because that's a brand new development, it allows us to actually start from scratch, not interfere with any of the current activities, as well as the Port of Mufa. Because again, that's one of the new ports, and it will allow us the opportunity to create these back of port activities in the manner in which we want to actually see them develop. Because I think the previous ports, we actually saw them develop on an ad hoc basis and without planning and without coordination. The N7, R27 stuff, we'll check out and come back to you. I really don't know the difference, but we'll definitely come back to you on that one. The movement of cargo from Cape Town to Saldanha is also something that I'm sure the planning guys have thought about or is in discussion, but we don't have the detail currently, and we'll respond to you on email, as well as the detail on the Saldanha. I think coming to Honourable Koronoff's comments and questions, I think the comment was actually validly made around the fact that this is not a Transnet plan. I think we realize that it actually is not a Transnet plan. And I think for the members, I'm not too sure if any members did attend, but we did have a market demand launch strategy on the 10th of May, where we launched this publicly. And I think the last slide or second last slide of that presentation was actually a stakeholder presentation. Actually, was a slide on stakeholders and what each stakeholder actually has to do in terms of Transnet being able to deliver on. And the caption of the thing was that this is not a Transnet plan, it's actually a South Africa Inc. plan. And that's why we actually, having said that statement, we then said all of these stakeholders, whether you're employees, unions, regulators, government, being DPE, DOT, policy departments, whoever, actually needs to come together to enable us to have a better than even chance of actually delivering on this plan. So I think that's a valid comment, and I think that's taken on board from our perspective. The committee has the assurance that we will be open, transparent, and wholly bound by our duties in terms of reporting to the committee, as we've done in the past. We will definitely come and speak to you guys when we have problems up front. As the chair requested, I think the reports that we'll be submitting will highlight those. And if there are issues, I think we'll be in a position to actually come and highlight that, as well as provide to the committee a context as to why we're in that situation, as well as what we would try to do to actually get out of the situation that we're in. And hopefully some of the plans that we put up and, you know, the plans that we put up are robust enough to actually prevent us from ever having to be in that position. But if we are, I think we'll definitely come to the committee and be open and honest about that. Some of the benefits to the ordinary South Africans was the next question. I think other than the whole skills development stuff that we've put up, skills development, we are cognizant of the fact, and I've made the comment, that we are training beyond our requirements. We've put up quite a, we don't need the 2,000 people that we're going to do in terms of apprentice, but we do today. So we're training for the economy. If we look at the economy-wide impact, we only need 19,000 people, but we have an impact of 600,000. So it's impacting the ordinary South Africa. If you look at the road to rail migration, it impacts South African immensely. You will see less trucks on the road. You will see that, you know, there will be indirect impacts in terms of taxation on individuals because National Treasury doesn't have to maintain the roads as much, doesn't have to make allocations for those things, and so on and so forth. The pipeline, for example, the greener economy, affects all of us because we're not moving so much of product on the roads anymore. We're moving to the pipeline. Less emissions, less safety issues from a perspective of having all this hazardous stuff moving on the road. And that's just to mention a couple of them, and there's many more of those, and we can make that available to committee if the committee actually so desires. I think the other question was on capacity in terms of 300 billion. Is it enough? And I think the question is, yeah, it's not enough. The conclusion that you've reached around the 300 billion definitely is that it's not enough. We currently have identified, as I've mentioned before, the DIA site, because if you're looking at the costing of the DIA site, it's anything north of 50 billion to establish the second dugout port in the port of Durban. And that, again, as I said to you, is not in the current plan. And in all likelihood, that will be some sort of build, operate, transfer, private sector participation type of model that we'll implement for that. Some of the other projects that we'll probably look at on a private sector participation basis is the inland terminal hub expansion as well, and I think that's probably in the region of about 10 billion or so. So what we've done is that we actually have anticipated the fact that we will require this type of private sector funding to ensure that we continue to keep pace with the demand of the economy. So we've actually created a structure within Transnet that actually particularly looks at the private sector participation and opportunity. So all they will have to do is go out and identify these opportunities and create a framework within which it will allow the private sector to participate with Transnet together with the approval from government around those particular projects and initiatives. Safe to say that any of the core assets of Transnet will not be private sector participation friendly. For example, the coal line or the iron ore line and so on and so forth will stay as Transnet assets. Having said that, on the smaller side of the PSP side, we've got the branch line network that is already identified as a private sector participation. The board has approved 3 of those branch lines already. We await PSMA approval for that. So those are some of the initiatives on the PSP side. The capacity to deliver was the next question on all the volumes. and the assurances from the committee in terms of how we're going to actually achieve these volumes. I think on the iron ore side, I think if you look at the historic performance on the iron ore side already, you'll see that I think when I started here 8-9 years ago, the iron ore line was at about 22-23 million tons. You already saw in that period of time that we've actually doubled the capacity. We're already moving 53 million tons, if not, yeah, about 53 million tons on that line already. So from that perspective, you will see that we have already had success in the past. The other reason why we think we are in a position to deliver on these volumes is that for the first time, I would think that we are in a very comfortable position where we're saying that the volume commitments that we're actually putting on the table in terms of what we're actually going to achieve is backed by capital commitments. So we've got very specific capital allocation, capital resources that will go out and actually ensure that we will deliver the volumes. So from the perspective of saying the 80 million tons or the 83 million tons on iron ore, for example, that has been broken down to say if we need to move 83 million tons, and given the fact that we know that the operational efficiency of the iron ore line is at a given standard, how many wagons do we require? How many locals do we require? If that is the frequency, what infrastructure requirements do we need to maintain that line over that period of time? So that's the level of detail that has actually gone into developing the 300 million. So if you then take the iron ore, the coal line, a similar type of process has gone through. If you look at the GSB, where the biggest volume is actually going to come from, you've seen the graph. 150 billion of the 300 billion is actually going into general freight. So a big portion of the entire capital spend is very volume related and asset backed. So you actually have assets that are dedicated to volume. The other piece of the pie is effectively to ensure that the customers are in a position to provide the volumes that we require and when we need to do that. And I think that we mitigate by the fact that we want to encourage customers to actually go out and take or pay contracts with us. So particularly the iron ore line, the coal line, and the 6 or 7 major GFB commodities that we see growth in. Because there's significant capital risk that we're taking in providing the capacity. So it's only fair that industry comes to the party and commits to the ramp up in volume, as well as commits to the fact that they will provide take or pay contracts. The question on operational efficiency in TFR, I think one of the slides that we haven't put up, but maybe it's actually worth our while to share with the committee, and we'll email that to the committee, the presentation that we actually made on the launch of the MDS publicly. In there, there's a lot more detail around the operational efficiency and what operational efficiency we actually see. And if you look at the freight rail side, there is significant operational efficiencies that we see coming through, particularly on on-time departures, on-time arrivals, wagon turnaround times, locomotive efficiencies, and the like. And there are double-digit improvements over the 7 years in those various key measures. On the port side, again, also operational efficiencies we are seeing, but not as significant as in the rail side, because obviously they're not on a lower base. So the rail side is also a lower base, therefore you're seeing the massive increase. And again, you may ask the question, so what assurance do we give you around why are we confident that this will happen? Again, because of the fact that we're recapitalizing the rail, in that there's going to be new assets, there's going to be new wagons, there's going to be new locos, less maintenance, less, there's going to be scheduled maintenance, scheduled railway, and so on and so forth. So the whole idea is that the fact, the plan, has to answer the question that if you're putting capital, what are you getting out? You need to get out the volume and you need to get out the operation efficiency so that you can demonstrate to the customer that yes, we are running this business on a basis that's actually sustainable going forward. The Cape gauge versus standard gauge debate, I'm not too sure if anyone here, Richard or Patrick, wants to take that question, or I see we may can have some.
No, go ahead.
I think the honourable member is right. This debate has been going on. This debate has been going on for a very long time. We suggested to the department quite recently, TPE, was to bring all the role players together, which did not happen in the past because everybody got views. And
fortunately or unfortunately, every one of these elements have got pros and cons. Now, where we sit, we're looking for clarity from a policy perspective. And we've got strong views as the operator on what we believe it will mean for us to switch over to another gauge. And so it's an ongoing discussion, but it's a very critical policy decision that I think our country should take. So hopefully very soon, together with the DOT, DPE, and ourselves, we need to come together in the same structure and then really propose this to government. And there must be a call made. But as we speak, for the medium, short to medium term, our investment is centering around the narrow gauge. Because we are busy, the railways can't be switched off until we switch the gauges. And until we get that policy clarity, that's where we will invest to make sure that we run the railways.
Thanks, Patrick. Mr. Chair, I've actually had the presentation, which I didn't know, but if you allow me the opportunity, I can go back to the operational efficiency question of Mr. Kornok. If we look at the 7 years, we look at general freight local efficiency. We're looking at a 35% improvement over the 7 years. General freight wagon turnaround time, a reduction of 38% over that period of time. Export coal local efficiency, an improvement of 12%. Export coal wagon cycle time, which is turnaround times again, a 10% reduction over that period of time. Export iron ore local efficiency, a 28% improvement. Export iron ore wagon cycle time, a reduction of about 16% over that period. So again, as you can see, there are significant operational efficiencies that are anticipated. Mr. Chair, your question around the interaction and cooperation between Transnet and, in this case, PRASA, your question around the factory. Mr. Chair, TRE currently does about R1 billion worth of work for PRASA as it stands. So there is interaction in terms of the two entities. We will, I think, through Richard's engineering outfit, respond to the RFPs that PRASA will issue out there in terms of their requirements. And based on the outcome of the procurement process, we will participate in that thought. And I know there's some discussions between the PRASA GCE and our current GCE around how we can, you know, streamline the process and ensure that some of the work that is required to be done is done by Richard's entity, but obviously respecting the procurement process of PRASA in the process. Responding to the Honourable Mokwena's questions around the declaration of a dividend, the Honourable Member is correct in that Transnet hasn't declared a dividend for the last 5 years, I think. And one of the reasoning behind that, Mr. Chair, is that from a purely finance perspective, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to actually, if you are in a net borrowing position, to declare dividends and then basically borrow money to pay dividends to governments, and then obviously it impacts your ability to actually do more on the capital side. So that's just a pure response in terms of the logic behind why we do not declare dividends. But I think government gets, via the state-owned company, indirect dividends from the fact that we pay taxes first, so there's dividends to bring to the fiscus. All the taxes, PAYE, VAT, income tax, a whole lot. So there's no special concessions on that perspective. And obviously, secondly...
Don't forget, Mr. Singh, that the government also gets rated by Moody's, etc., etc. So if there's not inflow of money, the government only relies on tax revenue. Then you see that affects the rating of the government itself. Don't just look at yourself and then say, no, we need to operate very well. So now what I would be, I actually dismembering the government from affecting its rating.
Thank you, Honourable Mokwena. I think that's a valid comment, and we'll take that on board. In terms of the 8.4 billion in recovery and how will we do that, I think the question is a valid question. And when we did come and explain to the committee, as well as when we explained to SCOPA, I think that was one of the questions that was asked. And if you look at the nature of the 8.4 billion, I think a big portion, I think it's probably the 8 billion of the number, actually relates to irregular expenditure. Now, and not for 1 minute when I give this explanation am I trying to water down the significance of the fact that we incurred this irregular expenditure. But the nature of the irregular expenditure was to the extent that we had not followed our internal procurement processes and policies that we actually outlined. So at no stage did fraudulent activity occur, or there were no indications of fraudulent activity, corrupt activity, biases in the tender process, and so on and so forth, that we could detect. So in some cases, the processes that were followed were not followed to the extent that it should have been, or the rigor that was supposed to have been applied was not applied. But in order to go out and recover the money, it would have to be in fruitless and wasteful expenditure. This was not in the category of fruitless and wasteful expenditure. It was irregular expenditure to the extent that we have not followed our internal procurement process. And to the extent that we've gone in and reviewed the 8 billion money, Transnet is quite comfortable that it did receive value for the 8 billion rand worth of services that it actually classified as irregular. So Mr. Chair, we still stand by that. In terms of the Africa interaction of Transnet, very valid point. We haven't covered anything in the presentation, but there is a significant drive from a Transnet perspective to actually get more involved in Africa. And to that extent, the board has received the first draft of an Africa strategy in terms of how Transnet wants to interact with Africa. And the thrust of those interactions will effectively be through the consensus arrangements that we have with Transnet. To reach the area in terms of the building of locomotives and wagons for African countries, the leasing of locomotives and wagons to African countries. Obviously, Richard plays a big role in the fact that he has gained the skill and confidence of the original equipment manufacturers. And they actually don't want to even set up another plant here, but they want to use Richard. And he becomes the patent or the licensed manufacturer on behalf of the OEM, and they can then access the African continent through Richard's operation. In terms of TFR, I think they're currently already operating in Africa. To the extent we can expand that, I think we will. On the pipeline side, we built the pipeline. We have learned a lot out of the building of the pipeline. We want to expand that via management consultancy type of agreements with other countries that actually build the pipeline. So that's going on. The other ports within the African continent, we want to actually create a cooperation agreement with them in terms of understanding how we can actually cooperate with them. One of the big things that will come out of the Africa strategy is obviously in how do we support the North-South corridor type of thinking, which obviously the president heads up. So that will also be one of the things that will come out in that strategy. We are earmarking the approval of that strategy to the board in terms of sometime in September or so. So the next time we actually present this to the portfolio committee, hopefully we'll see a big slide on Africa. In the launch presentation, there is a slide on Africa that details a little bit more around how we're going to be playing in Africa. So when the committee members get this presentation that I promised to give you, you'll see that there is a bit of Africa thinking in the Transnet's mindset at this point in time. Okay. Coming to Honorable Borman's questions. Patrick, I don't know if you want to just provide a little bit of clarification on the Swazi Rail Link funding. I'm sure we'll disclose that loop.
I think there was a lot of discussion around this, especially interest from the press when our group CEO announced this. I think we are mindful of the fact that there's question marks around the ability of Swaziland to cover their part of it. We are mindful of that. But one of the things that really would secure this project for us is the external financial interests from other investors. So other than just the Swazi government giving that guarantee, there's a lot of interest as well from other investors. If you can recall, the reason why we would like to do that link is to ensure that we release the GLP traffic and move more coal and faster on the line, so it will all are mindful of the risk, and we will ensure that we before we really finalize this, also to do due diligences around whether they'll be able to pay it or not. And if not, we'll then go to the private investors.
Thanks, Patrick. Then getting back to the second part of that first question from Honorable Bowman, in terms of, have all the costings been taken into account, how we plan to mitigate against the huge cost overrun that we've seen in projects previously. One of the things you'll recall in the presentation was the gold standard. And I think the reason why we've come up with the development of this gold standard is exactly for that reason, around the fact that we need to contain the costs. We need to ensure that the projects are delivered on schedule. We need to ensure that the scope of the projects don't continuously increase, and so on and so forth. So when we started out with the 300 billion as a concept, for example, if you look at the rollout of any, over the last 100 years, there's a study that we've done. If you look at the rollout of mega projects, and this is a mega, mega project, the 300 billion, history actually tells you that you will have a 30 to 40% capital overrun on these mega projects. So what we then said was, if that is the case, how do we then go about mitigating that? Because effectively then you're already sitting with a 400 billion plan rather than a 300 billion plan. So the gold standard actually is the standard that will be developed to ensure that that very concern that the Honorable Bowman raised actually doesn't eventuate. Because that's where the concern lies, is have you taken all your costings into account? And what we will do is, now that we've got the 300 billion, we'll go out and basically run an exercise to ensure that the 300 billion, is it 300 or is it something less? Can we do it in a more efficient manner? Do we change the designs? What do we do to actually make sure that the cost overruns actually do not eventuate? And you will have cost overruns, but the manner in which we actually respond to it to make sure that we deliver the 300 billion rand worth of portfolio of projects within the 300 billion. Because every single project cannot not have an overrun. We will have overrun, but it's how we actually respond and mitigate the risk of those overruns that the gold standard will provide us the ability to do. The question around how do we avoid fraud, corruption, mismanagement, I think is a valid question. In addition to the improvements that we've already put into the business as a result of the 8.4 billion that we reported previously to the committee, we are fully aware of the fact that, around the 300 billion there is a heightened concern around fraud, corruption, and mismanagement. So we're already putting in place controls around that. If you look at one of the requirements, an SOE is required by the PFMA to put a fraud prevention plan in place every year. So we responded to that. The fraud prevention plan specifically talks to NDS. And if there's 7 or 8 initiatives particularly targeted at fraud and corruption at all levels. To that extent, we've actually had about 9,000 employees go through a industrial theater that actually talks about fraud, corruption. What should you do if you encounter fraud or corruption? The use of the tip-off anonymous hotline, and so on and so forth. To create the tone at the top, we did that presentation to the board. So the board has already gotten a version of the industrial theater. Expo has gone through a version of the industrial theater. We've done about 9,000 employees in the last year. We plan to do about 15,000 in the coming year. And what we're going to do with the industrial theater in the coming year is that we're not going to have industrial theater that is a one-size-fits-all. We're actually going to tailor it so that when you talk to management, the industrial theater actually addresses management and what management have an ability to do and manipulate. When you're talking to blue-collar workers, you actually want to target and give different messages to the unionized workers. Because what we would like to do is we'd actually like to create a healthy tension between the unionized workers and management. There's much more unionized workers than there is management. So we want to use the unionized workers to actually keep management honest. In terms of the unionized workers see corrupt activities or see management perpetrating undesirable acts, they should use the tip-off anonymous hotline to report that. And we're going to do the same thing with suppliers, and we're going to do the same thing with customers. So there's quite a broad-ranging plan that we actually have in place as that emanates from the fraud risk management plan that we'll roll out throughout the organization. The housing issue around the land. I'm not too sure exactly which piece of land you're talking about, or the number of them, but I think from a Transnet perspective, we've always been supportive of the partner, the initiatives of the Human Settlement Department. So if there's any specifics, I'm more than happy to take that on board and try and clear any of the bottlenecks that we have. Because certainly we're not holding on to land because we want to. Other than for the core properties that are either port or rail properties, all of the other ones are for disposal subject to the moratorium that's been placed by the Department of Public Enterprise. So if there's certainly specific bits of land that you guys are looking for, we can obviously interact with our board and Department of Public Enterprises to facilitate that transfer to Human Settlement. And then the last question on training, I'm going to leave on to Nonko.
The last question by Honorable Sonto. We have answered partly this question. The number of employees that we are training, or the number of students that are training even now, currently, and going forward, are exceeding the needs of what Transnet will keep to replace aging workforce and also to keep to recruit internally. We are training much more than our requirements so that we can assist that as they assist to give us the skills that they can go out and find jobs outside with the required skills that they may have. We also go to the extra in providing batteries for students. Some of those students we are able to assimilate and offer them job opportunities, and those that we can't, they are free to go and find jobs wherever after they have qualified.
I say you didn't get the presentation. But you suggest that I don't read my document before I come.
Oh, okay.
You have been answered then in the presentation. Honorable Pololo, Honorable Nana. Honorable Mukwena and Honorable Borman.
Thank you very much. And, one
you're welcome,
one.
Honorable Nana.
Just a clarity-seeking question. With the construction of the coal line between Swaziland and South Africa, is it not making any business sense, for instance, if we could upgrade that Maputo harbour for the coal to be transported from Mpumalanga, because most of the coal, isn't it, that it's taken to, it's going for exports and all that. Does it not make any business sense if you could upgrade the Maputo harbour to from the mine house, instead of taking that coal from Maputo, going, in fact, even now with the construction of the Swaziland thing, to go straight to Richards Bay? Is it not too far? Are you not contemplating in future to upgrade the Maputo harbour? I think that was the other one. Thank you.
Chair, I can't really believe what Chris has just said, but yes, but we may be related to the Mozambicans because of our former president, but I don't think to an extent of investing so much money in Mozambique. Such money could be better used in South Africa. But that was besides the point, Chair. I accept that, but you know, there's a difference between Unyana and Usbayeni. Usbayeni is the son-in-law who takes everything to the family. So, lest we become Usbayeni, take everything to Mozambique.
Peter missed out on the biggest chunk of the presentation. But can I just say that I'm truly glad about what I want to show this presentation. Particularly that in my first interaction in 2009 with Transnet, I had raised an issue about East London. Hear me out, Chair, I'm not claiming it's a victory, but I'm just saying, indeed, Transnet has got an ear and they're listening. I'm truly thrilled about it. Having said that, Chair, you raised an issue about PRASA and Transnet. It's an issue I wanted to happen as well. It could be my little education, Chair, that I don't understand some of these dynamics and issues. PRASA is an agency owned by South African government. Transnet is a company owned by South African government. It's common knowledge that what PRASA requires to run its operations on a daily business, on a daily basis, Transnet has got capacity to produce locomotives, as we saw when we went to your factory. I fail to understand why should it be some kind of an arrangement between the GCO of this one and the GCO of this one, instead of being a policy issue that to keep money in this country, we need to have a cast in stone arrangement that for PRASA to get their locomotives, they must be manufactured by Transnet, or will continue losing money taken to Japan, money taken to these multinationals, money that never comes back to the country. If it does, it comes at a very small, at a very small scale, but the chunk of it goes abroad. That's the first point. It's probably an unfair question on the part of Transnet. It's probably something that, as a committee, we need to talk about in detail. The second one, Chatterson, in page 47 of the presentation, Transnet mentions that they are moving. They will be moving manganese to the port of Ngqura. Does that suggest, Chair, that the issue of the tank farm in the PE beachfront has it been resolved? Have you taken a decision to move it to Port of Ngqura? Thanks.
Just three quick ones. The first one, please ignore if I might have not read it, if you've touched on it. The gearing of Transnet currently, is Transnet geared or not? Does it know anybody? And what's the situation? You might have answered it, and I might have missed that. Just ignore it if you've answered it. The second one, Chairperson, is the Durban port, the new Durban port that's going to be dug out. I just wonder, Chairperson, what is the... We know we went there, and it's congested, but I'm just trying to think. Is it, from a cost-benefit point of view, is it cheaper to... It's not better to dredge and improve the existing infrastructure than to go and pick up a new port, build a new port? And that might actually save you money, sort of requiring 300 billion, it probably require less. Have you done that comparative analysis of picking up a new port, building a new port versus improving the existing one? Right. The last one, Chairperson, the portfolio committee last July went overseas to Venezuela. And when we were there, we informed, to our greatest surprise, that Venezuela was the world leader in the oil reserves. They surpassed Saudi Arabia. And what is germane here is the fact that there was an offer to our government to accommodate that oil in the silos that are here in Salo, down here. That are just lying fallow. Those huge silos that are just empty now. We could have that, those big tons of oil barrels brought this site for obvious benefits. Now, when we were having a summer school, a spring school, this was raised. I raised this one of the leaders there, and I'll find out from Transnet if there's been any follow-up. And because as this oversight, this is not just totally right, you know. When we go there, we pick up information that can be fed through to the different partners of government. Now, that's relevant to, in this case, to Transnet. And I forgot the name of the leader I shared this information with. She was in the summer school there. A very articulate lady. But all the board was late. Now, I told the 510%, has there been any follow-up in order to add value to our overseas trip?
Thank you. Yes, I first of all have just a couple of follow-up questions, and we've moved away a bit now from it, but just on the skills development, and I really commend you for what you are doing in the training side of things. With your own needs being supplied, you're obviously going to sort of take your, you know, the cherry pick, I suppose, is the word I would use. But what are you doing to, you know, sometimes people get training and then there's still no jobs out there. So are people aware that you're doing this training, that you have excess, that they can come to you, you know, other industries out there, and that, you know, there will be. So I'm really asking the question for those other 4,000 that will be looking for jobs as they go out, you know, what arrangements are there, or are there none? And then my second question relates to the policy issue, and I think this is really important, around the rail gauge thing. Now, I'm not hearing, and I know the Transport DOT or the policy department, but what are we doing to action something that we are talking to each other? So that would be the other. And then just one other thing I want to ask, and that is, on page 24, where you talk about changes to TRE in order to deliver MDF, you speak about accelerate women in rail engineering program to address the representation of women in managerial positions. And I'm wondering what you are doing, and I don't see that here, related to people with disabilities or special needs. You know, if there's anything that you, or is that fully taken care of, that's why it's not here. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, you'll forgive me for belaboring the point, but I'm going back to the Transnet pensioners. Chairperson, I'd like to know when, if the CEO or whoever she instructs will be meeting with the trustees of the pension fund, to discuss further bonuses, further increases, because as far as we understand at the moment, the annual increase of 75% of inflation. Chairperson, and it does worry me that cash injections to the pension fund do come from Transnet, and that these things haven't been budgeted for. So I would like to know when we can expect Transnet to be having their next meeting with the pension fund trustees.
Just a follow-up on the gauge issue and the reply the department has given. I just want to plead that when we discuss this issue, that we don't discuss it from an entity interesting point, but from a, what is in the economic interest of the country. Really, we need to, that should be the departing point. We don't have to debate it, as long as it's in the national interest and in the economic interest, and not necessarily in the entity interest.
That's a reaction to those few questions, and then
thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick, you want to take that Maputo one, the first one?
Yeah.
I think we lost an opportunity some years ago to, because if you could recall, the Maputo port was up for concessioning. The Maputo government put it out for tender. And obviously, hindsight is good science. We should have bid for that. But the Maputo port belongs to a private company called Green Road. So any development that we will do there is what the honorable member said. We would not just look at it from our other relationships as indicated, but also from an investment perspective. It would not make sense. We've lost that opportunity. It would have been ideal if that port was part of our establishment.
And I think to add to Patrick's response is that if you look at coal particularly, the coal majors actually own the export coal facility in RBCT. So to the extent any additional coal is dug out by those guys, they're going to use the existing facility first before thinking of moving into a Maputo environment. To the extent that other new players come into the market, there obviously is an opportunity to move through Maputo and so on and so forth. In terms of the PRASA, I think we've agreed that that's a policy issue, so we want to respond to that one. In terms of the manganese and going to Port of Mucha and the tank farms, yes, there has been a decision made to move the tank farms to Mucha, and I understand that the leases come up for expiry either 2015 or 2016. As soon as those leases have expired, the new leases will effectively be in the Port of Mucha, and there will be an open process with which that will be run, and obviously those tenders will then be allocated accordingly. In terms of the gearing of Transnet, at the management accounts at the end of March, we're sitting at about 41% gearing. So we do owe people money. We've got a borrowing, gross borrowing number of about 75 billion odd rand that we currently owe investors. And that is Transnet bonds, commercial paper, all the sources of funding that we just mentioned. In terms of the cost-benefit analysis around DIA, I think, yes, it is a valid question. I think it's more around the capacity constraints of the current port in terms of back-of-port facilities. We've done a number of scenarios in terms of understanding what phases do we actually expand the current Durban port. And one of the most feasible option at this stage is to actually create the dugout port rather than expand further into the main wharf area at the back. So at this point in time, this is probably the most feasible one from a cost-benefit perspective in terms of picking up a new port. So there has been various options that have been looked at, and yes, this is the one that's probably most amenable. In terms of the tanks in Saldanha, I'm not too sure if we as Transnet actually own any tanks in Saldanha. It might be that CEF and some of these other governmental organizations actually own those tanks. From a strategic supply perspective, but Transnet certainly doesn't have any of those tanks on its books currently that it can use to house any of these strategic fuel supplies, and I'm aware. Skills development and the disability stuff, I think Nongkyu can pick up, and then the rail gauge stuff I think we've responded to. I will just respond to the last question around the trustees. The trustees of the Transnet Pension Fund and management of Transnet are in constant communication, Mr. Chair. And, you know, based on the presentation that we made in October or November, you know, the trustees are quite comfortable that given the structuring of the fund, that they will be in a position to, subject to affordability and obviously market returns, be able to be in a position to provide those ad hoc bonuses going forward in terms of the benefits to the pensions.
We do not have formalized a relationship to assist those that we have trained. However, we do assist them in getting formal employment should the need come up to assist, but we don't have a formalized partner that we will send them up to. But going forward now with the numbers, it's now that we're beefing up a lot on the numbers, so we will also be requiring quite a lot of those employees to come on board, but we'll look at that point again. Okay. The issue on people with disability or those that have special needs, we have in this year we have a target of 1.3% of especially for people with disability. We have initiatives in place that we were planning to put in place to really achieve the target. In the last financial year, we achieved 0.8% of employees with disabilities, people with disabilities, to be on board. So those were just new that are coming on board. So we are looking at big initiatives to ensure that they have been taken care of. Chief has said. Another interesting point is that as we are finalizing the strategic performance objectives for Group EXCO members for this year, it was clearly emphasized that we must have the employment equity targets and also the skills development as mentioned and also people with disabilities to be accommodated in those strategic objectives so that they are also reviewed and rated on whether they are adding into the numbers. And that, I think, is going to assist a great lot because previously, as much as we had it in the plan, you'll find that in terms of implementing, nobody was going to be assessed and be checked as to whether you're going to meet the target or not. But now because the chief executives and the group executives, they have it in their FPOs, they will definitely be forced to implement because at the end of the financial year, they're going to be reviewed on it and be checked whether they met the 1.3% as they were expected to. So I think that is a great move also from group exercise to make sure that it's on the strategic objectives.
Thank you.
Now, we call this an ambitious program. You know, normally when we embark on such a program, we ourselves are a bit unsure whether or not we will succeed because it's so huge. But I think someone said it is not a Transnet project. It's a national project that belongs to all of us. You know, and what it then means is that we all have a responsibility to see to the success of this. Ours is not to wait for you to make mistakes and then come and wrap you over the knuckles and, you know, and just continue on that very negative way of doing things. But I think this committee has a responsibility to see to the success of this project. The department has a responsibility. Transnet has a responsibility. And that makes us partners, all of us. And I think, and the board, of course. We've learned a lot of lessons in executing the project for the 2010 Soccer World Cup project. That is a consistent monitoring of this project, proper planning and so on. At the end of the day, we win. You know? And that's why I was saying earlier on, let's not come in at the end of it, but be part of this whole process so that we can together, you know, find solutions that hold us back to issues that hold us back. You know. It then means that the DDG, for instance, in the department, Nepule, must know, you know, what's happening, you know, on a daily basis, what's happening all over the country where the project is unfolding. The board must make it their business. Board members must go out to this project. If whoever in the department is tasked with the success of this project, they must know where these projects are. You know, we as a committee must know where these projects are. We must put it in our own program. When we do oversight, we must know that we have to go and see for ourselves and not only depend on what you tell us when we meet. But we must meet the people who work on the project as well. So that we know now as we work that, okay, you know, in this 3 months, it means that from what we have done, what we have said to ourselves, this quarter tells us that, no, if we do things the way we are doing, we will meet our target. So I just want to thank you for this presentation and want to wish all of us well in executing this project. Thank you so much, and this brings us to the end of the meeting.
Thank you. I love that support. Very much, so great. But at least you were able to attend the room. That tells you whatever you had to pick out and come back. At least today you were here. Well, okay, not the whole thing. At least you can tell somebody the good news.
I'll give a full report.
It is
Someone has got to bring this to an end.
Yeah.
So, the same in the new policy that we